are Locked On NBA, your daily NBA podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
What's up and welcome to another Monday edition of Locked On NBA, the biggest stories with the local experts. I'm your Monday host, Jackson Gatlin, also host of Locked On Rockets right here on the Locked On Podcast Network. Now today, we'll be joined by John Corrales from Locked On Celtics to discuss Jason Tatum's historic Game 7, leading the Boston Celtics past the Philadelphia 76ers and back to the Eastern Conference Finals. Then we'll be joined by Brendan Kleen from Locked On Suns to break down why the Phoenix Suns fired Monty Williams after yet another disappointing postseason exit and what the next steps are for the Suns organization. Lastly, we'll be chatting with Rafael Barlow from Locked On NBA Big Board about Tuesday night's NBA draft lottery, which teams stand to gain or lose the most on lottery night, best landing spots for Victor Wembanyama, and more. Now, today's episode is brought to you by Prize Picks. First-time users can receive a 100% instant deposit match up to $100 with promo code Locked On. That's prizepicks.com, promo code Locked On. And as always, thank you so much for making Locked On NBA your first listen each and every day, free and available on all podcast platforms, including YouTube. Joining us now is the host of Locked On Celtics, John Corrales. You can track down wherever you listen to your podcasts and on YouTube. Just search Locked On Celtics. And John, the Celtics closing out things, a huge Game 7 win behind what is easily an all-time performance from Jason Tatum. Now the Celtics leading scorer in Game 7 playoff history, 51 points. He had 51 points, 13 rebounds, 5 dimes, 2 steals, no turnovers, an absolutely electric performance from Jason Tatum in this game. He was a man on a mission, and he delivered the Celtics a Game 7 win.
Boy, you know, when you put the numbers all together in a row like that, that sounds pretty good. considering Celtics history, you know, passing Sam Jones, which I think is the most underrated Celtic of all time. One of the most underrated all-time greats. Just going to get that Sam Jones plug in there. Yeah, I think Tatum's 51 points. Let's rewind and trace that back to the fourth quarter of Game 6, where he had a huge weight lifted off his shoulders. We talked about this before, and I feel like that performance, that kind of knowledge that, hey, you know what? I can go out there and suck for three quarters.
Because he had 3 points, for the context, right? He had 3 points through three quarters
three
in Game 6.
That's right. That's right. And in the fourth quarter, he had 16 and outscored the Sixers by himself. This is, by the way, he did that again in the third quarter of this game. So he personally has outscored the Sixers in 2 of 4 quarters going back to the fourth quarter of Game 6. Which is kind of wild, but hitting those shots, hitting those 4 3-pointers, I asked him about it after the game. And he's like, yeah, you know, it just kind of like, I knew I've played my worst and we were still able to get out of there. They had us on the ropes. We came back, we got that win. I felt good. And then he came in knowing that it's not so bad. It's not so bad. A couple of shots don't fall. It's not so bad. Joe Mazzulla said, I told him, don't listen to everybody and go out and try to get a couple easy buckets. That's what you and I think would say, get Jason Tatum going early and then see him cook. And Mazzulla's like, no, go out there and do what you do. Do the other stuff, defend, rebound, pass the ball, make the right play, the shots will fall. All that confidence built up from his coach from that previous game, I think manifested itself. And starting with the great defensive job that everybody did on Joel Embiid, and then Tatum could take advantage of Embiid, who was worn down by the third quarter. He did so much damage against Embiid, to pulling him out to the perimeter and getting to the rim. It was just incredible to watch all the different ways that Tatum could score.
The Celtics only led by 3 at halftime. How did Boston kind of blow the roof off this thing in that third quarter?
Yeah, I think starting in the second quarter, they calmed down. There was a point where Boston was down 8 and they had the flagrant foul on James Harden. And that keyed an 8-0 run. And Boston outscored Philly, I want to say 28-17 the rest of the way. That sent them into the half with some confidence. They knew that they had turned a corner. And in the third quarter, it was just Tatum finding the right matchups. It was Tatum just simply getting hot. But also, the Celtics got stops all over the floor. Harden hit one shot in that quarter. It was the only shot he hit in the second half. For a stretch there until about 2.5 minutes to go, Philly had only hit two shots the entire quarter. Meanwhile, the Celtics were just pouring it on over and over and over again. That defensive job, got to credit Al Horford again for just dominating that matchup against Embiid. The creative ways the Celtics were able to send doubles, late doubles. Robert Williams taking away the pick and roll that Harden and Embiid have been relying on. Embiid said it after the game. They took that away and they just kind of forced us to make plays other ways, and he couldn't do it. It just getting those stops, and the Celtics, once that water turned on with the three-pointers and Tatum started drilling three-pointers, that was it. It was a wrap. There was nothing anybody could do about that. Third quarter was as dominant a quarter as you're going to find in any NBA game anywhere.
Joe Mazzulla and his relative inexperience was definitely a factor going into these playoffs. He made the adjustment to go back to starting Rob Williams in game 6 and 7, kind of relying on that double big lineup quite a bit more over these last two games. How important was that change for Boston, and how much did you see Mazzulla kind of mature over the course of this 7-game series?
Yeah, I think that changed the entire series because, like I said, that now challenged the Sixers to do something away from the rim. They could no longer live in the paint, and that puts pressure on P.J. Tucker. Now, P.J. Tucker hit three of his first 5 3-pointers, but he only took one after that because the Celtics calmed down. The first, I want to say, 15 minutes of the game, you'd see the Celtics flying into the third row on closeouts. It was just ridiculous how overly hyped they were for this game and how fast they were playing. Once they calmed down, that game plan started to snap into place with Rob there in the middle to kind of patrol that paint, deter guys from getting to the rim and say, you're going to have to beat us from three. We don't believe that you can do that for 48 minutes. And they couldn't. Those shots just didn't fall. Tobias Harris, P.J. Tucker, those guys fell off. And with Harden locked up, with Embiid locked up, that was the difference in the game. But it starts with Rob in the middle of that paint and the way guys can play off of him. They just made it impossible for Philly to score.
I feel like I already know the answer to this one because you said his name, a couple moments ago, but outside of Tatum and Brown, who would you anoint the Celtics MVP for this series and why?
Oh, Sam Hauser easily. Yeah, of course it's Al Horford. Come on, man. Come on, Al Horford. He played like a 25-year-old out there. He was great. It's amazing to see Al Horford continue to be the best defender against Joel Embiid that the league has, basically.
He just has his number, man.
He's smart, but he's strong enough to handle some of the pressure, to handle some of the physicality. He's still athletic enough to get up there and challenge a shot. We know that Embiid's not 100%, so I'm not going to pretend that Embiid was out there going full Embiid and Horford was out there just denying him at every turn. That's not true, but that's the Embiid that was on the floor, and the Horford that was on the floor was better than him at a lot of turns. It's some of the best stretches defensively. You had Horford blocking Embiid straight up. It tells you how far Embiid really needs to go to be healthy, but also tells you how good Horford is positionally and his anticipation and his ability to go out there and guard a guy one-on-one, the MVP one-on-one, when you don't need to send help as often and you can stay home on those other guys. That's just a huge difference maker. And, in some ways it's a shame for Philly because they're back in that same spot after a second round exit, but it is what it is. And their other option would have been to not play Embiid and see if they could capture that game one matchup. And that didn't seem like an option. So Horford and his job against Embiid overall, he said he kind of sacrificed his offense a little bit to be that locked in on defense. And it really worked out.
Celtics moving on to a Eastern Conference Finals rematch with the Miami Heat. Now, things look a little bit different this time around than things did last year, but give us your prediction going into this Eastern Conference Finals rematch, John.
Yeah, it's it's tough to call, right? Because, I mean, the Celtics are clearly on paper the better team than this, the Miami Heat, right? They were the top seed for a long time. They fell to second, but everybody seems to say, hey, look, this is obviously the best team in the NBA, especially after Milwaukee got bounced by the Miami Heat. Miami doesn't really adhere to what the paper says, though. They are out there. They work harder than anybody. I know a lot of people in Boston like to make fun of the term Heat culture, but it works. It means something to them. And Spoelstra is the best coach in the NBA, probably. So it's going to be a tough series. Boston has the matchups. Boston has the advantages. You know, Tatum, Brown, Marcus Smart's better than, you know, Kyle Lowry at this point. Like, there's a lot of matchups. You sit there and be like, oh, wow, Boston has them most of the places. And we can argue about Jimmy Butler. I know Jimmy Butler's playoff Jimmy. And that's why I think the Celtics should win this series. But how does an 8 seed that lost a play-in game get this far? Other than they work hard. They don't care about what pundits say. And they are creative and smart, and they go out there and they make you beat them. That's going to be good for at least a couple of wins in this series. And if you say that effort is good for two, very easy to say Jimmy Butler is good for one, and Bam Adebayo's defense could be good for one, and that could get them to the final. So you can't take Miami lightly at all. I still think Boston should win this. If Boston plays like they did in game 7, they should win it easily. But we know Boston doesn't always play that way, so it'll be a tough series, I think.
For a full breakdown on this Boston Celtics Game 7 win and all of Boston's playoff action as they take on the Miami Heat moving into the next round, you'll have us covered over at Locked On Celtics. John, I appreciate you stopping by Locked On NBA with me.
I always appreciate you, Jackson.
Coming up, why did the Phoenix Suns fire head coach Monty Williams? What are the next steps for the organization moving forward? Who are some of the possible coaching replacements on the horizon? Could Ty Lue be in play for the Phoenix Suns? We're going to get there in just one moment. But first, today's episode is brought to you by Prize Picks. Next game, how about Nikola Jokic to score more than 26.5 points? What about LeBron James to have more than 7.5 rebounds? Or how about Jimmy Butler to have less than 6.5 assists? Or what about Jason Tatum to have more than 3.5 three-pointers made? So what is Prize Picks? It's daily fantasy sports, but how does it work? Basically, you pick 2 to 6 players, and if they score more or less than their Prize Picks projection, you can win up to 25 times back on your money on any entry that you submit. There's no competing against other people. It's just you versus the projections available. And PrizePicks offers projections on any sport that you watch. That's NBA, NFL, MLB, NHL, PGA. They've got you covered for all the action over at PrizePicks. Entries can be made in 60 seconds or less. It's that simple. They're safe. They offer fast withdrawals, currently operational in over 30 states and Canada. And right now, every day of the NBA playoffs and the finals, one PrizePicks user will win a chance at becoming a millionaire. But you got to download the app to find out how. So download the PrizePicks app or go to PrizePicks.com to sign up and play daily fantasy sports. First-time users can receive a 100% instant deposit match up to $100 with promo code LOCKEDON. If you deposit $100, PrizePicks will give you $100. If you deposit $50, PrizePicks will give you $50. So don't forget to enter promo code LOCKEDON at sign up for an instant deposit match up to $100. And continuing on here at Locked On NBA Monday, as always, thank you so much for making Locked On NBA part of your day every single day. Be sure to stay tuned in throughout the week as we have you covered for the NBA Draft Lottery results happening Tuesday night this week, as well as all of the postseason coverage right here at Locked On NBA. Joining us now is the host of Locked On Suns, Brendan Kleen, who you can track down wherever you listen to your podcasts and on YouTube. Just search Locked On Suns. And Brendan, the Suns with their second straight season of an embarrassing elimination game loss, early playoff exit, and this time around it led directly to the firing of head coach Monty Williams. So we got to start with that. I mean, is this the right move, the wrong move? Is it a reactionary move considering they were just in the finals 2 years ago under Monty?
I think it's the right move given a few things, and really it's despite how much change this organization has had in terms of the Kevin Durant trade, new ownership, some new voices. It still has ended with a lot of the same ingredients, you know, role players basically reduced to not much, not doing much in these elimination games. The offense feeling a little bit bogged down, guys not ready to sort of execute and be at their best. And, you know, there's obviously roster things. It's never one problem that you can attribute this stuff to, but you even listen to what Monty Williams said post game after game six and on Friday at media availability after the exit interviews that the teams do. And he was saying a lot of those same things. We need to adapt our offense. We need to use the regular season to be ready for some of these playoff matchups in a way we haven't in the past. Unfortunately, you know, those realizations or public admissions of those things, he's not going to have the chance to actually see those through, but I think those are going to be the same principles the Suns need to kind of have front of mind as they find whoever the next coach is going to be, because he was absolutely right about what the problem is.
How would you best describe Monty's tenure in Phoenix?
Game changing. I mean, that's the thing. It's as much as I can sit here and tell you that I think it was time for this move. This team was a laughingstock. This team was an absolute joke. This team was, I mean, had a very little of a fan base to speak of, had gone a decade with no playoff hopes, let alone actual success. I mean, they had one 48-win season where they were the best team to not make the playoffs in NBA history. And aside from that, it was just horrible season after horrible season after missed draft pick, after embarrassment and all this stuff. And now we know with Robert Sarver's whole tenure and the investigation into him, that things were really bleak around that organization. And so for Monty Williams to come in at the time that he did in the summer of 2019, when he had an offer on the table from the Los Angeles Lakers with LeBron James already in place and Anthony Davis on the way. And he said, no, thank you. I would like to go to Phoenix despite everything I just said. And when he came in, he changed everything. He got Booker to buy into a different type of a role and a bigger and better culture, got the most out of a lot of the young role players that they had drafted, and obviously turned this team into a winner, and they were in the finals 2 years later. So you cannot understate the impact that Monty Williams had. Unfortunately, it's just sort of the name of the game when you start to go big, you know, big fish chasing and everything else in the NBA, that these are the types of moves that often come after.
There's some early reporting that shows that Phoenix may try to pry Ty Lue away from the LA Clippers. How would you feel about Ty Lue in Phoenix? And if not Ty Lue, what are some of the other names kind of in the preliminary early stages of the coaching search that the Suns might be interested in?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I mean, Ty Lue popped up on the Bucks search already, right? In some of the reporting out there about Milwaukee's desires. He got named right away with the Suns from Mark Stein. I don't know if other people just know something we all don't, and Ty Lue is actually available, or if that's just, you know, wishful thinking. It's hard to say right now. If he's available, I think he should be at the top of most of these lists. I think the Suns would definitely benefit from him, somebody who's worked with superstars at every stop of his career and, you know, has that playoff pedigree of coming up with innovative game plans and getting his players to execute them in the postseason in the biggest moments. I think that's exactly what they should be looking for. If they're not able to get Lue, or if that's really just a pipe dream, I think it gets pretty dicey to me, because I think the two best pedigreed coaches, the types of coaches that you might want to go out and get if you were a title team with Milwaukee or Phoenix, are gone already. Quinn Snyder chose the Atlanta route for, you know, we don't necessarily know the reasons, probably some personnel power and maybe a nice salary, but that felt surprising because he could have had a lot more suitors. And then obviously Ime Udoka goes to Houston, where he might have some of the same power. He may, you know, just have liked that situation, or maybe it was one of the only ones he thought might be available to him. We don't know, but he's gone now. And so you look at Frank Vogel or, you know, Nick Nurse. I don't exactly look at those guys as people who are going to change what the problems that the Suns have right now are. I don't think of them as offensive innovators. I don't think of them as necessarily the most impactful veteran player development types of guys, which is what you're going to need for a team that's going to be capped out. All those things I don't associate with Vogel and Nurse. Not that they're bad coaches, not that they would be the wrong hire, but that's not where I would be looking. If that's the case, you might as well have just kept Monty Williams. So it's a tough thing. We've heard from Woj that that's where they're looking. couple of the other ones aren't available to the Suns as far as we would assume, right? Kenny Atkinson, probably not going to want to coach Kevin Durant again. Steve Nash, who has the franchise ties, probably not going to want to coach Kevin Durant again, right? So that's a little bit tough too. You're starting to run out of great options here. Maybe it's Mike Budenholzer. That would feel surprising. I don't love any of those guys, if I'm being honest, from a Suns standpoint.
Adrian Wojnarowski had some, I guess, some troubling wording in his initial report, for the end of season report on the Phoenix Suns, saying that Ishbia has fully taken over the franchise's basketball operations. And later on, that line was removed from his end of season report. How concerned should Suns fans be about this? First off, is this, in your eyes, accurate reporting? And again, how concerned should Suns fans be about this moving forward?
I mean, I'm not able to necessarily say if it's accurate. He did go back, Woj, and avoiding the sports media ins and outs as much as we can here, because I know it bores some people, but it's important from a Suns standpoint here to get exactly what it is that's going on. And Woj spoke about this move on the pregame show for this game 7 between Boston and Philadelphia, and he reiterated what was in the original article, even though the actual piece of that article that we're talking about is now gone. He said basically the same thing there. So I would imagine that is his genuine belief. It's hard to say right now if it's good or bad, right? There's plenty of organizations that have very involved owners, and we don't look at that as a negative. I tend to feel like the less owner involvement, the better in terms of the day-to-day decision-making. But at the same time, right, a big trade like Kevin Durant, a coaching change, those things sort of have to go through an owner. There's no way around that. It's too early to say if it's a good or a bad, but what I'll do is basically highlight the fact that, like a lot of owners, Ishbia went out of his way when he was first installed and to say, I'm going to let the great people who have had a lot of success in Phoenix the past 2 years do what it is that they do best, which is coach, run the organization from a basketball operations standpoint, et cetera. So if it is true that he's this quickly has moved on to something else, that is a little bit of a problem, because I think the reality is these things don't just happen overnight. But if you have an owner feeling like it should be happening overnight, I think that's the recipe for some problems between the people who are trying to do their jobs and the guy at the very top.
Ishbia might also be the only owner in NBA history with at least a +1 +/- rating so far as far as his on the court contributions.
Yes.
At this point.
And he's a basketball guy, right, too. So I think that's part of it. He was a college player and he's maintained all these relationships throughout his other career, where he's hiring people from Michigan State and around that community to his mortgage company. Like, he has kept those ties. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise that he would feel like he has a connection and some sort of know-how with this stuff. But I just think a young dude who came up through mortgaging is unlikely to be the smartest guy in the room from a basketball operations standpoint. But I guess time will tell.
Who will be the Suns' next head coach? How will Ishbia handle the franchise moving forward? You'll have us covered for all of that and more over at Locked On Suns. Brendan, I appreciate you stopping by Locked On NBA with me.
Anytime.
Coming up, which teams stand to gain or lose the most on a lottery night? What are the best landing spots for the crown jewel of this year's NBA draft cycle, Victor Wembanyama? We're going to get there in just one moment. And final segment here at Locked On NBA Monday. As always, thanks for making Locked On NBA part of your day every single day. Free and available on all podcast platforms, including YouTube. Joining us now is the host of the Locked On NBA Big Board podcast, Rafael Barlow, who you can track down wherever you listen to your podcasts and on YouTube. Just search Locked On NBA Big Board. And Rafael, it's that perfect, wonderful time of year with the NBA draft lottery right around the corner. So many storylines, so many narratives surrounding this year's NBA draft lottery. The crown jewel of the lottery being Victor Wembanyama, the projected number one overall pick. Let's start there. Which team in your eyes, and this could be one of the top teams, it could be one of the sleeper teams a little bit further down in the lottery, which team is the best landing spot for Wimby, and which team would you maybe be a little bit hesitant about him getting sent to?
But I see a Rockets jersey in your background. So is this Locked On NBA or Locked On Rockets?
Which hey, one? I don't have an NBA jersey to swap. First off, Olajuwon is an NBA legend. So we can his jersey can be up there regardless of what show I'm doing. But there is no Rockets contingent here. So just, you know, NBA focus only.
Okay, because I see a Rockets jersey, not an Olajuwon Raptors jersey. So. I think Vic can fit with any of the teams. I mean, he's that talented that you just build around him. I do think that San Antonio probably offers the most clear-cut opportunity for him to be like the guy, the go-to guy. I mean, I guess that's debatable, but I think with Houston, Jalen Green probably feels like it's his team. Jabari feels like it probably could be his team if he had the right, you know, situation. Alperen Şengün probably feels like he's the best player on the team. And there's some, I do think that Vic can fit, whether it's on Detroit or Charlotte or Houston or San Antonio. But like I said, I think San Antonio, he'd come in, he'd be the starter from day one on all of those teams. But I think the fit around him would be easy. I think Houston probably has the most talent. But I'm saying that because I really like Şengün. I really like Jalen Green.
You're not just trying to butter me up, are you? Okay, you don't get brownie points on this podcast for gassing up Houston.
What about a Built Bar? But I like Şengün a lot. But I do think that Vic is talented enough to where you can get really creative and have like this weird lineup of like Şengün and Vic and Jabari on the floor at the same time. Because I think Vic is going to be a floor spacer. But I mean, the length and athleticism that you have around Şengün and on top of Jalen Green. And so I think he can fit anywhere. I even think that you can play him with Jalen Duren in Detroit. And like I said, at San Antonio, he'd be their center from day one.
For those, you know, maybe a bit more unfamiliar with what makes Victor Wembanyama such a generational prospect, what is it that makes him so special?
We could start that he's 7'5". I mean, we could probably start from there. He's 7'5". He's athletic. I mean, he's a vertical lob threat that can reach heights that nobody else can get to. It's like a 7'9" wingspan. But you can't necessarily put him in a box as a center. Usually when you think 7'5", you think of back to the basket center. Now, this guy's like 7'5" with wing skills. I mean, there's videos of him shooting one-leg three-pointers, handling the ball. There was a clip that went viral a few weeks back where he shot a step-back three, missed it, and then got his own tip dunk. Like, you'd have to watch it to believe it. But, I mean, he's special. And I haven't even touched on the defensive end. I think that's where he could probably have the best impact right away. He's skinny. He's going to need to bulk up, but he's a tremendous shot blocker with his length and timing. And he's not a big that you can switch out on the perimeter and take advantage of him in space, because he's coordinated and fluid enough to where he can, you know, match the guard step by step. And if you do beat him off the dribble, he has this massive wingspan that's as long as the Seine River or I-45. Whatever. I mean, it's this crazy long wingspan. So if you beat him off the dribble, he can alter your shot. So I mean, he's just an incredible, incredible prospect.
So Victor is clear-cut, the far and away favorite to go number one overall. He's the grand prize of this year's draft lottery. The team that gets the number one pick is likely going to take him unless they, you know, do something weird. There's still a lot of really great talent at the top of this year's draft, though. Namely, we got Scoot Henderson, Brandon Miller, two incredibly talented prospects in their own right. At this point, is Scoot Henderson a lock to go to whoever gets the number two overall pick, or is there a chance he maybe falls down to three or maybe even lower than that? Like, which teams might actually pass on Scoot Henderson if they land the number two overall pick?
Yeah, I can't see him falling past number three. I still think the best chance, I think he's more likely to go number two. But I do think that if Detroit has the number two pick, then then I mean,
things maybe get a little interesting, right? You got Cade Cunningham, Jaden Ivey.
And I mean, you get another floor spacer and Brandon Miller, which is something that Detroit didn't have outside of Bojan Bogdanovic. I mean, I know the conventional wisdom is draft the best player available. I still think that's even a little bit debatable. But even if you believe Scoot is the best player available, I think Cade Cunningham is really, really good. I think Jaden Ivey is really good. And I think if you put all three of those guys together, even though the NBA is positionless, you don't maximize all of their strengths because you have too many overlapping skill sets. So if I'm Detroit, I'm taking Brandon Miller. If I'm Houston, that's a tough one. If I'm San Antonio, I think I would go with Scoot Henderson. Houston is the one where I think it can really go either way.
I'd be sad to see it go the Brandon Miller route. I'm just going to go ahead and give that answer right now. The Rockets need a point guard. They need a real point guard, and Scoot Henderson, I think he's the truth personally. But when you look at the other teams throughout this lottery, you know, the ones at the top, obviously Houston, San Antonio, Detroit, but which team, or it could be multiple teams in your eyes, have the most riding on the outcome of this year's draft lottery?
That's actually a good question, because I think every team has a lot riding. I think a lot of teams are hoping that they can be a playoff team, at least a play-in team next year. You look at the Thunder, they've shown that you don't have to, you know, rebuild for 4 or 5 years to, you know, to put together a good team. I mean, the first couple of teams that come to mind is Charlotte, for example. If Charlotte wins the lottery, does Michael Jordan sell the Hornets? Because every foolish mistake that Charlotte or any team has made can be completely covered up if you draft Wembanyama. He can cover up all the mistakes. So I think Charlotte is an example. Even Portland. Portland, if Portland wins the lottery, even gets a top three pick, now they'll have to decide, do we move this pick for some immediate veteran help? Or do we just continue to add young guys around Dame? And then if Dame decides that he wants out, then we already kind of have our young core intact. So, like I said, those two come to mind. I mean, I thought about something today, maybe a little crazy. I don't think it's going to happen, but, you know, everybody's talking about, well, maybe Dame wants out, but Dame has been pretty adamant about staying and maybe wavered on it a little bit. What if Embiid wants out? What if Embiid decides, like,
ooh, yeah, after that disappointing game 7, it could happen.
Yeah. So what if Embiid decides he wants out? He's been in Philly for, I mean, I guess what he got drafted in, what, 14, and then he missed 2 years, but he's never been past the second round. So if Embiid says, hey, I want out, then if Portland gets a top three pick, all of a sudden, I think that could be an interesting trade part. I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here. I don't think that it will happen at all. But if Portland gets, like I said, a top three pick, or even if they go where they're projected at number 5, and if they're trying to win right away, then I could see them moving that pick, and they may be able to get some value there.
Who will ultimately win the NBA draft lottery? Where will Victor Wembanyama get drafted to? You'll have us covered for all of that and more over at Locked On NBA Big Board. Rafael, I appreciate you stopping by Locked On NBA with me.
Anytime, man. I know this is Locked On NBA, but good luck to you on Tuesday.
I appreciate it. That's going to do it for another Monday edition of Locked On NBA. As always, thank you so much for checking out the show. If you haven't done so yet, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcasts. That's Apple, Spotify, Google, the Odyssey app, free and available on all podcast platforms. We're also available on YouTube. Just go to YouTube, search Locked On NBA. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe. But as always, thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to having you back right here at Locked On NBA, the biggest stories with the local experts.